Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon to everyone on today's PPSC PDP call on Thursday, the 22nd of April. We have Jeff Newman, Alex Gakuru, Gabriel Pinheiro, Tatiana Kramsova, James Bladel, Paul Diaz, David Maher, Alan Greenberg. From staff, we have Marika Konings, Glenn de Saint-Géry, Margie Milan, Liz Gaster, and myself, Gisela Gruber-White, and we have apologies from Michaeli Malon. If I could please just remind everyone to state their names when speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you. Over to you, Jeff.
Thank you very much. This is Jeff Newman, Chair of the PDP Work Team of the PPSC. It is You said the date, and I just totally left me.
It might be the 22nd.
It would be the 22nd. Thank you. good start to the meeting, huh? Anyway, welcome everyone, and we got a pretty full agenda, lots of items to talk about. Continue where we left off on the last call. One thing I do want to note is that in response to a question we had on translation, Marika has sent around a document, which I guess she got some statistics on the number of documents that were translated and number of page views. We do not have a statistics yet on whether people responded with comments in any of those languages. Marika has just posted that up on the Adobe just to show you. It's there's a Word document and then there's an Excel spreadsheet. Probably the Word document, which is the one that's up there now, is the easier of the ones to kind of take a look at. And not really much to say about it at this point. I think people should just take a look at it and glean whatever they can out of it. So with that said, Marika, is there anything else you want to say about the document?
No, this is Marika. I think I'll go back and see if they can provide you with some more specific information on public comment periods that were held in other languages. And as said, I think on the previous meeting, I think there were only a few, and the only one I had direct experience with was one that we ran for the IRTP Part B working group, where we did a little experiment on having the public comment forum and the announcement in the other UN languages, but we actually didn't receive any comments in other languages in on that occasion.
Okay. Alan, you have a question?
No, not a question. I just wanted to let you know the vertical integration analysis team was scheduled starting in 25 minutes, so I'm going to be dropping off of this call at that point. There's no recording of that one, so I don't think I have much choice but to attend.
Okay, thanks, Alan. And I'll get on those guys for scheduling some conflicting call. No, I'm kidding. Okay. So with that said, there are a couple outstanding items that I have. I was a little detained this last week, so I have some items on my plate to solicit feedback. One of the other things is that, as Glenn, some of you may have heard, but I'll repeat it just so that it's on the record. In Brussels, our meeting day is on Sunday, and it's going to be from 10:30 a.m. until 12:30 p.m. That's 2 hours on that Sunday in Brussels at that time. So for those of you planning your trip out there, if you could make sure that you're there for the Sunday meeting, I think that'll be a good time to get together face-to-face. Any questions on that? Okay, great. Let's jump right in to where we left off, which was, and I'll give a second for Marika to post it. We were talking about, this is on the overarching issues, and we're just trying to go over all of the voting thresholds that we had talked about through the different phases. We had left off on, we talked about raising an issue. We spent a lot of time talking about raising an issue. And some of the members of the work team were had expressed some comments about wanting to possibly increase the threshold, and others were not in favor of that. And ultimately, what we had discussed, which I need to put out to the list because I'd like to get some more feedback, was that there really could be a dependency or is a dependency on the prioritization effort that's underway with the GNSO, meaning that, you know, you could initiate, you could raise the issue, you could even initiate a PDP in theory, but the question is that then once it's raised, once the issue is raised, could the GNSO Council decide to prioritize it in such a manner where it may not be taken up right away due to the fact of a number of PDPs or other efforts that may not be PDPs are actually being done at the same time. So the action item, because I don't want to go over that ground again, is I'm going to basically send out some questions to the list to see if we can get some comments in writing. We talked about the threshold for initiating the PDP, if it's in scope, and we left off on initiating a PDP if it's not within scope, and remember that not within scope means that it's not within the scope of the GNSO or ICANN, or I should say not within the scope of ICANN and the GNSO. It does not mean not in scope of a consensus policy as defined in the contracts with the registries and registrars. So in other words, something could be within the scope of the GNSO, but not within the scope of the, quote, picket fence, and that would require the lower threshold. What we're talking about now is something that the ICANN Council has determined in the issues report is not within the scope of the GNSO. And for that, we have said that a GNSO supermajority vote would be required to initiate a PDP, which means, as defined currently in the bylaws, that 75% of one house and, not or, but and a majority of the other house. So is there any discussion on that? I see James has his hand raised. So James?
Yeah, just maybe for my benefit, if I'm the only one that's not getting this, that's fine. But can someone provide an example of a type of an issue? Maybe Margie can help me here with an issue that would be... that would fall into this category of an out-of-scope PDP?
I can. This came up on another call, and somebody asked me the question, and I was thinking about it. And this is Margie, by the way. Think of a PDP on fast flux, for example, or phishing, just to say if that were the case. And the group came up with recommendations that applied to both GTLDs and non- you know, and as maybe a referral or a recommendation that the CCNSO should pick it up. So you know, there could be things that are outside the scope of the GNSO, but the GNSO may feel like they should at least, you know, address it in some informal way. And so that was the kind of thing that I was thinking about.
Can I respond to that real quickly, Jeff? I'm sorry, I took my hand down.
Yeah, sure. And then I'll go to Ivory.
I mean, the question is that still a PDP, or is that something else?
In my view, as I was trying to think this through, because I've had the same kind of puzzle in my head, it would come out of a PDP. So, you know, the GNSO would start on some generic, some high-level topic, and then as part of doing that analysis, they might, you know, see that application other...
You're still here.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So, Margie, you still there?
Margie disconnected, sorry. She'll be dialing in shortly.
Okay.
I guess, Jeff, I don't want to belabor this, Jeff. My only question was that, you know, if we're using the terminology correctly is all.
Sorry, so what terminology are you referring to?
Well, if something is out of scope and yet we're submitting it to a policy development you know, and we know that at the outset. Is it still policy development, or are we acknowledging that it's just some sort of a working group effort? I don't, you know, I'm just having a tough time wrapping my mind around the idea that there would be this initial and acknowledged contradiction.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because you're right. The working group, or sorry, the council could always get around this by just calling it a working group, but then it's got no something has to be a PDP in order to even have a chance of being. I see what you're saying. It does. It's a very good question as to whether something that's out of scope is even a PDP or whether it's just a working group. Marika, do you have something to add on that, or?
Yeah, this is Marika. I'm just wondering, at the time that this was written, if that was still under the impression, because we know we had a discussion over the confusion on what's in scope, what's out scope. Is it possible that this clause referred to issues that were not in scope of consensus policies at the time when, you know, people believed that policy development could only take place on developing consensus policies? In that context, it would make sense, because you say, okay, on things on the picket in with inside the picket fence, you need a normal threshold. But if you try to make, you know, binding policies on issues that are outside of the picket fence, you would need a genus of supermajority in order to initiate a PDP. Could that have been the thinking for that clause? And indeed, if we're talking now that, you know, with the understanding that scope is not related to the picket fence and the consensus policies, but it's, you know, ICANN's mission and scope of the genus O,
well,
that clause might not make sense anymore.
I can answer that from my perspective when we wrote it, but I can't put myself in other people's shoes. In my mind, it was there was no such thing as the creation of a working group that wasn't part of everything was a policy development process. Everything. The whole notion of the GNSO Council creating working groups that weren't part of a PDP process was not something that had ever been done prior to coming up with those set of bylaws. So I think the genus of council kind of changed the game a little bit by creating these working groups. But the point when we were writing it was that the genus of should not really be getting into areas that were outside the scope of the genus of, that it should focus on only things that were inside the scope, and there was no bifurcation of working groups and PDP. Everything was a PDP, whether or not it was inside the picket fence. I don't know if that helps because things have evolved since then, and that distinction may be meaningless. But that was my thinking in it when we were drafting this a long time ago. Avery, do you have a comment on this?
I have a comment both on that, and I had another issue related to the supermajority that I was going to bring up before this was put on the table.
I will let's start with the comment on this topic, and then we'll come back to Alan and your. Yeah, let's start with a comment on this point brought up by James.
Okay. Yeah, I would tend to believe that as long as what's being done is talking about policy and such, I would actually believe that the policy development process would be a correct name for it. I don't think that there needs to be a process for policy that is in scope and a process for policies that may be out of scope, whichever definition we're using. I think there's obviously a different result if you do a policy on something that is out of scope in the meaning of not under consensus / picket fence, or you do something that some people, you know, that staff may believe is outside of the mission scope. Those obviously would have different results, varying from irrelevant to totally irrelevant, or semi-relevant to irrelevant. But I don't think that that's a reason to not call it a policy development process, because from the perspective of GNSO, what they would be doing was talking about policy and doing some development on policy. And to define many different processes to handle these things, I think is, you know, just creating more work for ourselves that isn't needed.
Okay.
Hand up.
And I'll come back. Yeah, keep your hand up, Aubrey. Alan, do you have a comment on this or something?
No, on this.
Okay, Alan.
In the recent past, starting in 2006, the GNSO did a PDP on GTLD contractual terms. That was deemed to be outside of the GNSO scope, but it proceeded anyway. There's a higher threshold for approving. There's a higher threshold for the board refusing it. But it's the example in recent memory of a PDP which was not within GNSO scope, but was proceeded with anyway.
Thanks, Alan. That should have been one I thought of as I was part of that. But that's a good example. I don't know, James, if that helps you. I'm not sure if you were around at that point, but that was when there were some elements in the contract that some of the constituencies, or the registry contracts, that some of the constituencies, including the registrars, wanted to do a policy development process to change, and the ICANN Council came back and said that's outside the scope, it's outside the picket fence, and it's outside the these are private negotiations or private contracts between ICANN and the registry, and these particular items were not necessarily within the scope. And the GNSO Council voted with this increased threshold to continue on with it. It turns out what happened is that they obviously weren't implemented against the existing registries, but some of those points did find its way into the new GTLD registry agreements. I don't know if that helps you, James, as an example.
Yeah, it helps. That helps. Thanks.
But I do think it's a good, and then I'll turn it over to Margie, I do think it's a very good question as to what the distinction is between the creation of a working group and policy development. You know, one could argue that the new GTLDs was just the creation of a working group on it, not policy development. But one could also argue the other way, that of course, that was policy development as well.
Jeff, can I get back in on that?
Yeah, Alan,
yep.
And then I'll go to Margie.
The difference is, with appropriate thresholds, this is a mechanism by which the GNSO can force the board to address something, and if there's not sufficient cause to refuse it, to force the board to accept it, whereas just a working group has absolutely no power to escalate it and cause the board to address things. So the PDP is the only mechanism the GNSO formally has to bring something to the board.
That's a very good point, Alan. And Marika, we should probably take note of that in the report to stress that. I think that's a very good point. Margie, do you want to address that as well?
If we're thinking about this in terms of this would have to apply to anything that the GNSO does, I would probably caution against that, because I think, you know, there are situations where the formalities of going through an issues report and, you know, all the steps and all the public comment periods may not be, the best thing for the particular issue. And, like, one example that comes to mind is, you know, as we put together the working group for STI, we had a short time frame from, you know, in which to come up with the recommendations. And if we had to go through the, you know, issues report and all the steps for a formal PDP, it just wouldn't have happened in time. So I do see value in allowing the GNSO to do things that aren't, necessarily following the quote PDP rules.
Yep. But in that case, the board requested it, so it wasn't an issue of how do we get to the board's attention.
Right. So I think both of you, Alan and Margie, have good points. I think Margie's point is good in the sense of, you know, it preserves some flexibility for the GNSO Council to get some sort of advice in the less formalistic manner. And I think Alan's point is great as well in that, you know, the only way to really, unless it's requested by the board in the case of like the STI, it's really the PDP is the only mechanism we have to force the board to address it, not to adopt it necessarily, but to address it. And then there are some limitations, there are some rules and things that the board has to, they have their own formalities in dealing with PDPs. So I think that's a good point. Avery, next.
Okay. The next one. This has to do with something that sort of bothers me with just having supermajority vote defined as we do now, with the
Avery, still there?
Yeah, I'm still there. I lost my train of thought for a moment.
Oh, okay.
I guess what I keep looking at the supermajority and look at the needing 75% of one house and majority of other houses. Now, there's another way of translating what used to be supermajority, and that was two-thirds of the council. Now, I know this is not likely to happen these days because, at least within the contracted party's house, voting is by a block, and so therefore that skews the way things are. But that is not necessarily predicated to always be the case, and it's certainly not written in any of the bylaws or council documents. So it occurs to me that if no one was constrained to vote, and especially as registries and registrars get much bigger and get more diverse, no stakeholder group is constrained to vote as a block for all time. So it could be possible that we would end up in situations where you could have a supermajority of each house, or, you know, but not have a 75% threshold in any one house. So you've still reached what is, by all accounts, a supermajority, and as two-thirds of the people have gone for it, and et cetera, and even proportional to the number, two-thirds have gone for it. So I'm wondering whether we shouldn't also include a proper supermajority, where you don't have 75% of one house, you've got 66 of both, or you know, what have you. So that's the concern I've got. I know that, you know, with people voting as a block, it makes it less of a concern. But it is only one vote either way. But I wanted to put that on the table. Thanks.
So if I could just summarize, you would have a either-or situation where it would be defined as either the 75% of one house and a majority of the other, or 66% of both houses.
Yeah.
Does anyone have any thoughts on that? I'm just trying to think at this point that you have four stakeholder groups. Alan, you have a comment?
Yeah, I mean, going back to how this was derived, we were trying to find something which is roughly equivalent to 66% of the entire council, but not requiring, but still allowing a reasonable dissent. And this is what we came up with. I think if someone had suggested what Avery's saying at that time, it probably would have been accepted when we came up with this. You know, it's another slightly different flavor of moving the balance slightly away of variation between the houses, but still about 66% across the board. So, I would have no problem with it. It's a subtle case. I'm not sure it'll show up all that often, but I would have no trouble adding it.
This is Aubrey. If I can add something, when we were talking about that, Alan is right. What we were worried about was how to keep it from being blocked if somebody didn't want it, more than what does two-thirds mean, although we did talk about it, and it was a 30-day cycle. So, and that's why, it's because every time I see it, that's what's been concerning me.
So, does anybody have any other thoughts on that, or, you know, as something to put out for comments to the list? I don't think at this point in the structure, I don't think that really changes. I'm just trying to see if how many people. So, you know, obviously we have different number of councilors in each of the houses, right? Whereas the contracted party's house has only seven councilors, right? The three registry, three registrars, and one non-voting.
It's one person. It's one vote more or less.
So you would need five of. So you would
five
need
five at 75, and you need four at 66.
No, I think it's five at 66 and six at.
Oh, okay. Yeah, if we're rounding up, I forget how we round, but yeah.
Right.
So it's a one-person difference.
Right, so you would just need one so if it was the registrars that wanted it, let's say, you would need the nominating committee and one registry as opposed to the nominating committee and two registries.
Right.
And for the other house, I think it would, well...
It works out the same.
Yeah, it's just double the members, but it's... Alan, you have a comment?
Yeah, I think it has some merit. I think it could well have been there. Using the logic we used, if we had had more time, so there's no reason not to put it in. Presuming we're going to be ending up recommending some bylaw changes, I would think there's no reason not to put it in at this point. We can always reject it.
Okay, why don't we put that in as an option and certainly put it out for comment? It's something that there may be some others that were on that initial working group that came up with that compromise. They may have something that they thought of. So I don't see any issue, and I'm looking at, you know, there's a lot of people on this call that haven't made any comments. Thanks, Alan. I know you're dropping off.
Okay. Bye-bye.
So we'll put it out for comment on the list, and absent any strong opposition from people on the list, I think it's something we could certainly put as an option in the draft on this issue. Aubrey, you have a...
Yeah, I just wanted to add one comment to that. This is not something that I suggested that got rejected previously. I just want to mention that. It's just something that never came up.
Okay. Why don't we then jump on to number three, which is the vote to approve the charter. So this is something we added that was not part of the bylaws at all. This is something we added through our discussions, although there obviously are votes by the council now to approve a charter. What our general rule was, or that we had proposed during the discussions, was that the threshold for approving the charter should be the same as the threshold for initiating the PDP in the first place. That if it was that it was so instrumental that if it was greater than the threshold, in other words, right now you only need 33% of the council members of each house, if it's within scope. If it was greater than that, i.e. requiring a majority of the council, then you could essentially have it easily blocked. If someone didn't want it initiated, they could they don't have a choice on the initiation, but they could block it at the charter stage. Conversely, though, I think that was basically the rationale why we had this creating the same standard. Does anyone disagree that the voting on approving the charter, and I'm not going over the next question. Well, we will go over the next question in a second, but this is just on the approval, not modifications. So on the approval of a charter, does anyone have an issue with the same threshold as it took to initiate the PDP in the first place? James agrees with it. Anyone disagree with that? Okay, seeing no disagreement, and obviously people can file comments on the list. Now the question is, what about modifications to the charter? This is not something we really delved into, but we certainly discussed the concept of, you know, the charter is approved by the council. One of the first items that's usually discussed by a working group is, you know, are there any changes that the working group wants to make to the charter or recommend to the charter? And if there are, that goes back to council. So my question to everyone is, does the same standard apply as approving the charter in the first place? In other words, does it need, if it's within scope, 33% of the council of each members or more than 66% of one house, or do we just go with a straight regular majority vote in that circumstance? The proposal on the table is to have the same standard as the approval of the charter, but let's hear some comments. So, James?
Yeah, Jeff, so if I'm understanding this correctly, the working group's been approved, it's been chartered, and then at some point later on in that course of the lifespan of the PDP, it comes back to council wanting some changes to the charter, and we're trying to set what the voting threshold would be for that, right?
Yes.
Okay, so, you know, my feeling is that that should be an extraordinary circumstance and require a supermajority in all circumstances, regardless of what the threshold was to get the thing started and to get the charter approved. But it also opens an interesting question in my mind, which is at what point does an amendment or a tweak or an adjustment to a charter mean that you're really kind of rebooting the whole PDP effort and you should really start back at square one?
That last point is a really good one. Do you want to maybe distinguish between things that are material and not material, and obviously have the council in a position of determining whether it's material or not?
I'm not sure I want to wade into those waters. but it sure seems like, you know, for example, we've seen a couple of examples, let's say, where things that are held up as adjustments or modifications or amendments, and then when one puts them under a microscope, they turn out to be, really wholesale changes to something. And I just want to make sure that we're not creating the mechanism by which PDPs, you know, start off as an apple and midway through change into an orange. I don't really know how to state that elegantly, but I'm just concerned that that's the vulnerability we're creating here.
Okay, I'm going to go to Marge and then Paul.
Jeff, I wanted to go back to the vote for approving the charter, because this actually came up in the earlier versions of the VI charter for vertical integration. And essentially what happened there is it got really confusing, because if you apply the 33% standard, you could have that vote apply to two charters. Because you don't need a majority to do that. So if there's two conflicting charters that are possible, you could have 33% of the council vote of each house for one, and then 33% of the rest of the members vote for the other. And then you get in this like situation on, well, which motion goes first? It's really a weird situation. And what we ended up, the way we looked at it for that vote a few months ago was since charter wasn't required at all, that we viewed that you could always just proceed with a PDP without a charter, and ended up applying the majority standard, because there was a potential for having a conflict. You could have have both votes passed for two conflicting charters, and then what do you do?
So I think now we are requiring a charter, so now it really becomes a big issue. Okay, well, let's, Paul, I'm going to come back to you, because I do want to tackle this that Margie's just brought up, because it really goes to the threshold of the 33% on approving the charter. Do people have thoughts on that? I think that's an interesting issue. Aubrey?
No, Paul had his hand up. I was just sort of saying, yeah, but I got to get my hand up. Sorry.
Okay. Paul, do you have a comment on this, or?
No, I want to go back to what James said. Still trying to think of an answer for this question you just put on the table, Jeff.
All right, let's continue with this one, and then we'll come back to James's point on the modifications. So, Aubrey, you have your hand up now.
Yeah, sorry, and I shouldn't have burbled. I guess I actually think that that's a really good point, and. Perhaps approving charters, because once the PDP is approved, then there's actually no reason that a charter shouldn't be a majority-based item.
Well, so then the other complicating factor is one could present the charter along with the initiation of the PDP, right? I mean, it's not always at a separate point in time.
But we can require that it be a separate, a separate motion. That's easy enough to sort of say. And in fact, when I was, playing in the role of chair, I always was confused by it when it got bundled,
because it made it a very, whereas you might want to disagree with aspects of charter, but you want to agree to the PDP in principle, it makes it a harder discussion to hold. So I think that first you initiate a PDP, and then you vote to approve a charter. Voting approving the charter could be made something that was just simple majority, like most things in the council are supposed to be, because you've already gone through the effort of you know, making it an official action. So that's just my thought on it. But having them bundled is always confusing. And Margie's right. You know, when I noticed on VI that there was two competing charters or such, and how does that happen? Whereas if you have one charter and sets of amendments, then it's clear how the process needs to run. First you vote amendments if they're not friendly, given, you know, GNSO's interesting notion about friendly amendments, and then, you know, you go into the motion of the charter itself.
Okay. And Paul, let me know if you have a comment on this issue, or it's just a placeholder for the next one. Margie and then James.
Yeah. Again, you know, we really went wrangled on this issue when it came up in the VI, and I think the reason we ended up having problems with it being majority vote for a charter is that now you're increasing the vote. It's the concern that, you know, we've intentionally lowered the threshold to start a PDP at 33%. And so for the folks that didn't, you know, between 33% and 50% that didn't want the PDP to proceed, they could game the charter vote so that you'd never have a charter that got passed, and therefore the PDP couldn't proceed. And so the reason we were okay with majority was because we came to the conclusion, well, charter is not required, so if it turns out that we don't get majority vote, so what? We'll just proceed and then people have no rules. But if you require a charter and you require a 50% vote, you're essentially having conflict with that lower threshold to start the PDP, or at least there's a potential for that. And so that, you know, so that's just something that we kind of grappled with when we were dealing with that voting issue.
Let me go to the initial question in that and throw it out to the group, make sure we're all on the same page. We have discussed oftentimes in this group that a charter is essential, that the group must have a charter, must have a scope that's within the charter, and must stay within that. Obviously a little bit of flexibility, but is there anyone that wants to, you know, Margie raised the point of, well, maybe you could just have no charter and then the group continues. Does anyone agree with that approach, or do people generally agree that a group must have a charter? Because then we could then we can work, you know, down the line if we all agree on that aspect.
This is Marika. Can I just add something?
Sure.
Because just on that notion, I mean, looking at the bylaws, I mean, maybe a reason as well why, you know, a working group doesn't require a charter currently in the bylaws is that under the task force it actually does require a charter. So maybe the assumption was, of course, when the bylaws were drafted that the task force would be the guiding model, and, you know, that might be a reason why it actually wasn't in there. But if you would now move indeed to a situation where the working group is a dominant model, I would assume that you then as well take that, you know, the elements that is currently in the bylaws that talk about the charter or terms of reference, that you would follow that practice. So to provide some additional background on that.
Well, I think that's a difference. See, the task, the way it was initially created was a working group of the council, meant that it was really comprised of council members, as opposed to a task force which was made up of community members. So I think right now we're talking about working groups made up of community members. I don't think you're comparing apples to apples now. We've kind of made hybrids of each in order to avoid the formalities of the PD, of what's in the bylaws for task forces. But really, we are creating task for all working groups. Really, mostly now are task forces. We've just worked around the existing bylaws. Paul, you have a comment on this?
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. I mean, isn't that sort of the problem, and isn't that why we're here today? That, you know, because we didn't stay within the rules over time, things have evolved to a point where there's confusion, and we get ourselves into these kind of dead ends, you know, where we're not sure what we're doing, so, okay, we just make it up as we go. To answer your question, I think that you know, if we're going to follow this through, working groups, since they are treated like the historical task forces in practice today, let's call it what it is and apply the rules that we're working on to the groups that we have today. And basically put whatever is there historically, it's being moved aside. That's what this working group is, what this PDP is all about, is trying to bring the guidelines that we operate within, operate under, up into the reality that we work with today.
So, and I think that's right. Is there a way to, in order to prevent the gaming that Margie was talking about and Marika, if we all agree that it should have a charter, is there any way to basically say, look, the PDP is initiated, but we really need to force the council members to work together in order to approve a charter? And that's just one of the inherent risks, is that it may be held up for a while. But, you know, if I don't know, we're just trying to talk here, come up with something. Is there anything we could do to prevent the gaming that was discussed? Or is that gaming actually kind of helpful in a certain way? Does it force the parties to work together? Paul?
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. You're thinking out loud exactly what I wanted to get to when I had my hand up earlier. All these concerns, as you start thinking about one thing, you know, you're peeling an onion here. I mean, there's so many layers. This concern about gaming, if a working group determines after some period of time that the original charter is not appropriate to the task at hand, if they go back to council, the question that you and James raised earlier is, if there's going to be some form of material change, is that going to necessitate restarting the entire process, or what voting thresholds there? And if it does require a restart, is that almost an unintended consequence of the rules that, you know, it's a way to game the system that you can't move forward? My question would be, if we set a high threshold, I think James had offered a supermajority vote to change, all right, that's the highest threshold, not even a majority. You know, the lowest level, I guess, would be that 33%, again, assuming it was in scope. What happens if, you know, they come back and the counselors, they can't reach whatever level of support we've approved? Is that working group now in some sort of limbo, and they can't move forward, they can't get their charter changed? What happens? And I'm glad you raised the point, so I'm just trying to echo what you've just said, Jeff, for the group discussion and perhaps on the list to get more inputs as well. I don't know. I mean, it just seems like there's a tremendous opportunity for gridlock, if not gaming.
What about could you say, I'm just throwing this out there, maybe an awful idea, but could you say that if there are multiple charters passed by the council, that it ultimately goes to the working group, by a majority of the working group, decides on or recommends to the council what they believe the charter should be, and then absent any kind of supermajority or even majority of the council, that then becomes the charter. In other words, fine, if the council can't do the job and you're going to have conflicts, then it's left to the working group. The working group makes its recommendation, and then only if there's a majority that opposes that recommendation of the working group can the council actually change it. Again, that's kind of radical. It may be a dumb idea, but just trying to throw it out there. Does anyone have a thought on that one?
Yeah, Jeff, this is James.
James, okay.
Yeah, I just, I know we're brainstorming here, but that idea scares the heck out of me. So,
it does?
A self-chartering working group is kind of, you know, I think what that... And I don't want to belabor this a little too much. I think another radical idea, Jeff, and maybe one that's a little safer, would be the idea of, once a charter is gone through a drafting team that is approved by council, that's it. Your only options are to proceed with the charter you have or terminate the working group.
I think, James, I think the issue is even on the approval of the initial charter, right? This is what we had with VI. You had 33% of the council support one version, 33% of the council support another version, and in theory you could have had the other 33% supporting a third version. So now you have three technically approved – well, actually you can't have – sorry. You have two technically approved charters. And what do you do at that point?
You're saying that they approved at 33%.
Right. So you could have 33% of the council, 33% of the members of 33% of the members of each house may support one version, and 33% of the members of each house may support another version. So
okay, you know, the going back to my former days in math, I might say that you'd need to design the voting threshold so that doesn't occur. A working group should have, if it's a working group that's been authorized or a PDP that's been authorized, it should have one and only one charter, and then that charter should essentially be static, barring some very unusual and extraordinary circumstances. Otherwise, we get the situation that you're talking about, or we get into a situation where the drafting team's recommendations are essentially thrown out the window, and the working group or the council, you know, completely transforms the charter, or we get into a situation where people join the working group with their stated goal, or maybe not stated, but with their intentions to get the charter modified from day one. And I just think that sabotages the whole process.
Well, you could have one house, 100% of one house, so it's 100% of the contracted parties support one version of the charter, 100% of the non-contracted parties support another version of the charter. It's not even math. I mean,
well, then you don't have a charter, right?
You'd have to basically say that. You'd have to reconstruct all of the values in order to make sure that couldn't happen.
Right. I mean, the resolution of a problem or a lack of consensus on the council is not to push that down to the working group where it's only going to get worse. You know, that problem has to be resolved at the council level or it needs to be, you know, I just feel like, you know, taking a problem in one body and moving it to another body rarely results in a better approach to the problem, and typically, you know, it makes it much worse. And Paul and I think some other folks here have been on working groups where the charter is a very tenuous and very weak, but it's really the only anchor we've got. And so I'm thinking if you take that away from some of the working groups, or you make it so that the charter is in doubt or in question or open for debate or fluid or can be going back to the council multiple times for modifications, I think these working groups really lose whatever direction and guidance they have and become completely ungrounded. I'm sorry to use such strong language, but I think we're building a time bomb into this process if we're not careful.
So, okay, Margie, you have your hand up.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what James is saying, because if you throw it down to the working group, remember the participation in the group, you know, varies, and it's not consistent with what the council, you know, framework is. And so you may have over-representation of one group, not others, and that might skew where the charter should go. So that was my first point. And the second point, I just wanted to, you know, I know I mentioned gaming, but I didn't believe that was happening in the VI group at all. I think there's legitimate times where, you know, various stakeholder groups have just opposite opinions on things. And to say, we'll just work it out or something, they'll just have to work it out. Sometimes it's just not practical because people are on, you know, opposing sides legitimately because it affects their business in different ways. And so I still come back to the notion that I was comfortable with as well, we don't necessarily need a charter. I mean, maybe, you know, maybe that's the approach, is we recommend that they do the work and try to come up with a charter, but that if in the end there is no agreement, the PDP will just proceed. And I know that's, you know, awkward and everything, but, you know, at least that gives people incentive to try to have some parameters for a charter and try to work together.
I think what you're hearing, though, Margie, from the group and what's come across is that I'll throw it out again if anyone disagrees, but I don't think people in this group agree that a group should not have a charter. In other words, I think what people are saying here is that unless there's a charter, really can't proceed. And Aubrey's raising her hand, so maybe I'm wrong on that. That's just been the discussion. So let me, Aubrey, on that point.
Yeah. I guess I believe it's a little looser than that. I certainly believe that a group should be able to start even if it doesn't have a completed charter. I think that given bottom-up nature, once the PDP has been initiated by the managers in the GNSO, I certainly think that it is quite reasonable for a working group to basically have to negotiate their charter. And I think we have to be careful to not bind things so much. So, yes, the council still needs to approve that charter. But if a group starts without a charter and just the motion, and instead of spending a month with a drafting team trying to create a charter, the new way that things have evolved is that the PDP sets the basic conditions, the working group is created, and the working group negotiates its charter with the council, becomes a method of working. That shouldn't be prohibited. That shouldn't be something that can happen. Again, yes, the council's always the manager. The council's the one to make sure that the work items are eventually agreed upon. But to say that you can't have a working group without it having an approved charter, I think would be going too far to sort of limiting the flexibility of this method of working and remove its bottom-up nature.
Okay, Paul, do you have a comment on this?
Yeah, I do, Jeff. Thanks. I'm just not sure, Avery, while I'm sympathetic to the idea of providing flexibility to the people actually doing the work, I'm not sure that that's really going to play out the way we want in the real world. What I was going to add, and echoing something Margie said, you know, there will be instances where there are PDPs that get underway and the composition of the group is dealing with the work may be skewed in a particular way. And if you give that working group, if we give that working group too much flexibility in crafting the charter, you might wind up having the situation where the working group, because you know you've got a whole bunch of people who are very passionate about a particular point of view, they may basically, you know, vote to kill it off before it even gets started. I mean, I've got an example in mind, a working group that's underway right now. Unfortunately, Alan's off the call, but you know, it's his group. Post expiration, domain name recovery, the group. You know, this PDP got started. The registrar and stakeholder group voted against it. We've shown up. Registrars have shown up in mass. There's, you know, in the regular participants, I'd say 80% are registrars. Quite honestly, most of the people in that group would like to kill this thing off completely. You know, they never wanted it in the first place. If they had had that sort of flexibility in crafting the charter, I can almost assure you it would have gone back to council with a vote to shut it down. So I think if we are talking about moving forward without the council-approved charter and sort of like, here it is, live with it, if you have a big problem, you come back, and that brings us back to what are material changes and how do we handle them. But I think if you push it down too much, it may sound nice, but I think the reality is that you've created an enormous gaming opportunity where people who are pushing very hard for a particular position can basically stack the vote, and you know, we're going to create a lot of problems.
It's a difficult issue. I want to go to James and then Aubrey.
Yeah, real quickly, I just wanted to disagree with Aubrey, what she had said earlier. I think the charter is really a very relaxed and casual way to set some boundaries around working groups, what topics are under discussion and what topics are off discussion, because let's face it, everything is independent or interdependent on everything else. I'm concerned that the idea that a working group would go forward without a charter or with multiple charters, I think is a recipe for a dysfunctional group, from stage one, step one. So I think that, the guiding principle here should be one group, one charter, and conversely, one charter, one group. When we mentioned that, it's possible that we had two charters separated, supported by different aspects of the community, you could essentially say that you've got two working groups. They're sharing the same teleconference, but they're really two separate working groups. So I think that that's a situation also that should be avoided. And I think that, the bottom-up principle is important, and, but we need to have some level of appropriateness of where do we say that, the bottom-up process has, is every decision at every level open to every person in the community to revisit that? Can I join Ellen's post-expiry call and start talking about who is policy? It's very, very loose and casual the way it is right now, and I'm afraid if we remove the last illusions of boundaries, it'll turn into a free-for-all.
So I'm going to turn it over to Aubrey to answer that, and she's next anyway. But if I heard Aubrey correct, I don't think she's saying there shouldn't be a charter. I think what she was saying was that you could have the working group, and the working group would then work on the charter with the ultimate goal of getting the council to pass it. But ultimately, if the council didn't pass it, then the working group couldn't go any further than that. But, Aubrey, is that what you're saying, or did I miss?
Yes, thank you. I was afraid that I had spoken extremely badly. So, yeah, in talking about flexibility, first of all, yes, if the council wants to write up a charter and send it down and allow just a little bit of questioning, and then they could do that. But that requires that they're using the strategy mechanism in the middle to write the charter, because the council itself doesn't actually sit there and write a charter. It puts together a drafting team, which looks very much like the core of a working group anyway. But delays the organizational structure, and it takes about a month to put together a working group fully and getting everybody in and on all of that. But all I was saying is that it could allow for a working group to take the resolution that says a PDP is going to resolve A, B, C, D, and ask the working group to propose a charter that fits within those, that then the council has to approve, disapprove, and that you might end up with a negotiation back and forth. And exactly as Jeff said, until such time as you have that charter agreed to by the council, you do not have work items. And,
yes.
And if at any point that negotiation stalls, the council can just say, okay, here's the charter. But it's just basically a way to open it up to flexibility. And remembering absolutely everything in ICANN can be gamed. There's no way we're going to invent a set of rules that someone cleverer than us isn't going to figure out how to game. That's not a reason to not do things. We just have to be careful.
So with that said, I see Paul's laughing. It doesn't sound like Aubrey and James, your position is that far apart, or is that part at all. It sounds like, what Aubrey's saying is just look, let's not foreclose the opportunity of creating the working group, because maybe the working group could help broker a solution to something that council has not been able to solve itself. But still, the council has to approve it before the working group does the substantive work. Would that mean then that we'd be in favor of making the approval of the charter 50% as opposed to the 33%? Or do we still need to go back, or I should say greater than 50%? Majority. How's that? Majority. Aubrey?
Oh, sorry. My hand is just left up.
Oh, okay. Margie?
Yeah, actually, I had a different topic. It was trying to propose maybe a different alternative approach. If there's a deadlock, you know, and we can't get a charter approved on whatever the threshold is, that you have a select group of people that will resolve the differences. So, in other words, it might be the chairs and the MCAs or something. I'm just, you know, throwing out, you know, kind of like a deadlock rule, which is not uncommon in the corporate world where you've got voting agreements for ownership. So it's a little just different approach.
So, okay, to have some sort of piece, to have some people which may or may not be council members, but some sort of group that could help broker deal. Okay, Paul, you have thoughts on that one?
Yeah, it's actually more of a question for Margie's question for the whole group. You know, look, what are we dealing with here? We're dealing with the PDP, policy development process. A lot of times these disagreements are over a fundamental disagreement between parties about whether this could or should lead to policy. You know, we talk about in scope and out of scope and all the rest, but, you know, there are a lot of issues that get developed as policy work or get addressed under some form of policy work. And, you know, when they're started, we kind of go into it with a question mark. Will this even is there a realistic chance this is going to lead to any sort of policy or best practice recommendation? And I think when you have these very strong disconnects, and you know, just suggesting that maybe we have some extra group that can help arbitrate, it's not that simple. The disagreement exists because there's this fundamental difference of view about what ICANN should be doing, the limitations on its mandate, etc. And you know, I've always viewed PDPs, anytime one gets initiated, it should be reserved for the big issues, and something meaningful should come out of it. It shouldn't be 18 months of debate, and then you come out with some wishy-washy, you know, there was some agreement and some disagreement, you know, and that's just my view. But, you know, we're trying to scope things out here. I just would, you know, caution, when you have these very strong disagreements, I think it's often because it gets to the core of whatever the issue is that's been put on the table, and it's being pushed by a particular minority, you know, that met a threshold according to the rules. But you know, there's a big block that says no, we disagree. You know, that needs to be accepted for what it is, and if they can't work it out, both in the charter and then in a functioning working group, accept that for what it is. That this issue, there's nothing that's going to come out of it.
Margie, do you have your, is that new or is that left up?
Yeah, it's new. I guess it's in response to Paul. I get that for issues that are maybe new, but there might be time constraints that will force people to work together regardless of the fight on the charter. So whatever happens on the charter, and again, BI is a perfect example. You know, we went through a month of debate on the charter, and it really, you know, deferred the working group work for a while unnecessarily when people were trying to shoot for a specific deadline. Maybe the deadline's the launch of the new GTLD program. Maybe it's something that ICANN is doing, you know, where the time, there's a, you know, it's something else. If there's a time constraint. And so even though, you know, we got to a point where we finally agreed on a charter, you know, I think that once it's done, people, if they've got this other pressure, will work together. I mean, I'm hopeful, and come up with a consensus position. So I'm just pointing out that the dispute over the charter may not necessarily mean that we can't reach consensus.
All right. Let me. Alex. Yep.
Yes. I was just wondering, what if we get them at the rates we are proposing of one house at 3%, and in view of the foreseen scenarios of gridlocks, we create another condition where we can say in the event of this happening, then we invent the circumstance under which maybe the council would have to act so that we still maintain a low threshold for entry or starting our PDP. But then in the event that, like the VI scenario repeats itself, we create some different set of rules how to resolve that. Thanks.
Yeah, Alex, I think that's good. I think I was going to say something similar. Could you have this threshold, but in the event of more than one charter being proposed that can attain this vote, then the council must approve one of the charters by a majority of both houses. So, in other words, the general rule is it's the same as initiating the PDP, but in the event of a conflict where there's multiple, then it requires a majority. Is that a solution? I mean, that's kind of what Alex was saying. And Margie, does that solve the issue? You'll still have a little.
I still think you have the same problem because if you can't pass it by 33% and others know that there's that possibility, then it just won't. I mean, I don't think you're going to end up in the same situation. You just got an extra step.
Yeah, but I think a majority of the PDPs, most of the PDPs, if you go back in history, I would say 90% of them, you have no issue. 90% of them, people just vote for it, or you get much more than 33%. Very rare that you don't. It almost sounds like, and some people have expressed that look, the council needs to kind of grow up a little bit, and if it needs to work these issues out, that's what the meaning of consensus is. And, you know, it can initiate the PDP, but it's got to agree, people need to take some responsibilities, and if they're just gaming, then perhaps, you know, there's a problem with the structure of the GNSO as opposed to, you know, this process. We're not going to solve the gaming issues. It's going to happen, but it just seems like to me that you kind of got to force these people into a room and say, look, you got to agree on the charter. And you also need to get people to get responsible, too. So the people that oppose it should not be using it as a political tool to refuse a charter, that they should grow up and understand that, look, there is going to be a PDP on this, and we need to force ourselves to work together to come to some compromise, kind of like what Paul was saying, which is, you know, you don't want to set the threshold so low to initiate a PDP, which it is pretty low now, but not be able to have something that's implementable in the end because you're not going to have a working group that's going to work together anyway. James, your thought?
Jeff, I just wanted to endorse what you were saying there just a minute ago about, you know, making a decision, making a call. ICANN is a very elaborate engine for deferring decisions or passing decisions around without actually, you know, making a call. And I think that's part of what one of the things that frustrates some folks. You know, but I think that there's some chat going on between Paul and I on the list here. But the idea is that we're running into a collision between the idea that we should be a bottom-up and flexible organization with everybody having input into the process versus the idea that consensus governs. And if you don't have consensus, you don't have an issue. You know, and I think that's really what we're getting down to is that, you know, it doesn't matter if we want to continue to allow additional voices to come in and provide input into the process. If there's no consensus, the process can't proceed. So that's where we're bumping into, I think.
So anyone that hasn't spoken, have any, or even if you have any thoughts on that? Essentially what we're saying is the proposal is that the threshold for approving the charter is, as we've recommended, the 33% of each house or more than 66% of one house. But in the event that there's multiple charters or options that fall within that standard, then at that point we need a majority of the council to approve the charter. Aubrey?
Yeah, sorry. I'm getting my hand up. I hadn't spoken before because I'm getting confused. I think maybe it makes sense to use majority to discriminate between the options. But if you're going, I guess I really don't understand how this voting is going. And I can't, from what's been said already, say, oh, okay, then in this situation, this is what they would do.
Yeah, let me give you an example that might help, okay? So let's say we had an issue like VI, and let's say 100% of the contracted parties supported one version of the charter, 100% of the non-contracted parties supported another version of the charter, right? So now let me take a step back. Let's do the easy case. The easy case is, which is 90% of the PDPs, is a charter that meets the threshold, and there's usually not a competing charter. And the threshold here is 33% of the councils of each house or more than 66% vote of one house. Okay, that's the easy case. There's no problems. There's no conflicts. That's great. That's the same as initiating the PDP. But now I'll take the example I gave, like VI, where you could, in theory, have contracted party support, 100% of the members support one version of the charter, 100% of the non-contracted parties support another. In that case, you meet the threshold and you have two charters. At that point that you have two charters, now you go back to square one and say, okay, one of those charters needs to be agreed upon by a majority of both houses.
But since you can't vote on two things at the same time, you could actually, I mean, it can happen. We're talking about the council here. It can happen that you would have the vote on one, it would get its threshold, and then you'd have the vote on the other, and it would get its threshold. As I say, I mean, yeah, logically you would say, no, that could never happen. But we're talking about the council, we're talking about people sometimes making a vote based on agreements and other trade-offs. We're also talking about perhaps the space of time between two votes where we don't know the conditions have stayed the same. So in essence, you can have two of them that would also get the majority.
I think that's probably going to be less likely.
It's less likely, but what we've done is, by again, anything that can be gamed will be gamed. Any rule we make can be gamed. I could see people playing that. I could see if somebody wanted to force a stalemate and you got two or three people from each of the houses to agree that they wanted to force a stalemate, they could do that.
Well, if the council...
Again, this is the council we're talking about.
But if the council chair allows two motions to be raised, each of them gets majority support, then the council chair needs to go, okay, guys, we have two. We need one. We need to work this out, or otherwise we don't have a group. We can't do any further work.
And that's why I'm thinking that perhaps in defining a system, we perhaps need to define one that prevents that up front. And perhaps what we need to sort of say, since we have this notion of majority, is that if there are two, and as it's not going to be that there's two separate charters generally, like in the VI case, there was one charter where two of the items were not agreed upon and therefore were sent back to the council. So the council could very well do a majority vote on anything that is questionable. And before voting on the charter, like you do with amendments, you vote on options using majority, but the charter gets approved at that level. And if you can't get a majority for either of the options, then you do exactly what the council did this time. You put in a third option that punts it back to the group and says, you know, we couldn't agree either, therefore your first task is going to be this. That gets approved by majority. That gets stuck in the charter, and then the charter gets approved by whatever group this group approves of. So, because what we're really talking about when we have options on a charter is amendments to that charter that hadn't been agreed to. So I don't know. I think the other option, as it's been described, can lead to the same sort of static standoff.
Okay. Wow. So what I think might be helpful, Marika, is, and then I'll go to Margie, is if we could write kind of a synopsis of just this issue, kind of a summary of the problem, the options we've talked about, the pros and cons, and put that out for the list. I think there are some commonalities. I think the group does agree that without a charter, the working group's not really going to have any task. If the working group is created to help develop the charter, that's okay. But if the charter is not approved by the council, one charter, then the working group is not going to have any deliverables and therefore really not going to progress in the PDP process past that charter phase. It does sound like, general, where there's not a conflict, the standard on approving the charter should be as we've kind of recommended. But where there's a conflict on any part of the charter or the charter as a whole, there needs to be some mechanism to come out of that process with one version that will guide the working group. And it sounds like a majority of the council will probably be needed. A majority of both houses will probably be needed for that one version. How we get there is something we need to finalize. But it sounds like that's where we're heading. Margie, you have a comment?
A different approach maybe is to flip it and have the majority vote be on the priority of the motions for the various charters. So you get the majority vote to figure out which motion goes first, and then you use the lower threshold, voting threshold, to decide on that first motion. You know, all right, that's the rest. Because I think that's part of the problem, is just trying to figure out which one goes first, and that was some of the complexity that we faced.
Well, I mean, if both motions go through, then you're left with the same situation of you don't have one charter. And then they have to go back and approve one charter with 50%. I think we can't, my own personal opinion, so you could please feel free to disagree, but it sounds like we're babying the council. And I think the council chair is going to have a role in basically saying, we can't have two charters. We've just approved two charters. Both motions went up. We got to try again, and we got to keep trying until we get it right. It sounds like, I hear what you're saying, Margie, but it's almost like we're babying them. In a sense, maybe it's some commentary from our part. Say, look, you know, we realize this could happen, but we expect a strong chair and leadership within the council to avoid this. And the approval of two conflicting charters is no better than not having a charter at all. And so you got to come back with one and keep trying. Maybe I have a little bit more faith in even the people that like to game the system. So can we write that up and then throw that out to the list, Marika?
Yes.
Now, the last point, we have 10 minutes left, so assuming we can get to one version, let's say there are modifications, legitimate modifications to the charter where the working group has started its... I'm sorry, I'm reading James's comment that says you probably shouldn't put in the word baby the council. So now the question is, through legitimate work of the working group, it's been working, and then all of a sudden, wait a minute, we uncover something as part of the working group that wasn't in the charter, but the working group feels, consensus of the working group feels like the charter should be amended to encompass that extra area, and so it wants to recommend that to the council. James's comment was that may require, his recommendation was, well, look, it should require a supermajority because we don't want to necessarily reopen the whole process. So, James, did I summarize that right?
Yeah, Jeff, and that's correct. And again, I don't think necessarily this is about gaming. I think that the series of higher TP charters is a good example where as we get going through the first instance, IRTPA, in which Paul was the chair, we found that there were some issues that we could move around from, let's say, C into B, and we could defer some issues down into other charters. So I think that you know, there's a perfect example where the flexibility works. But, you know, in those situations, it's pretty clear that it's going to enjoy strong consensus, strong support, you know, to move those things around. If they don't, then, you know, I think that they should have stayed the way they, you know, if there was a controversy in us doing that, I think that they should have stayed the way that they were originally approved. So, you know, so I think that having a high threshold here would ensure that, you know, you still have that flexibility to move work items around in a way that's more efficient or relevant. But yet, it doesn't mean that people go into the working group, and I don't mean necessarily in bad faith, but people join a working group with the intention to get the charter changed.
Well, so you had suggested supermajority. Is that maybe too high? What about just a regular majority of both houses?
I don't know. I feel like that almost begs it to become more commonplace, and I think that that's the other extreme we need to be wary of. If it is extraordinary and it's for situations that, you know, enjoy broad support, I think that, you know, I think that having a supermajority should not be a barrier to those types of situations.
Okay. Alex says supermajority minimizes later gaming chance. Does anyone disagree then with a modification being a GNSO supermajority? Or do we distinguish between administrative modifications like the one that you were talking about, James, you know, substantive ones, which is always a tough one? Aubrey's got an X. I don't know if that was to my idea or to James's. Aubrey, which one is that an X to?
It was an X to require supermajority to change a charter. I think we're just pouring too much concrete here, and we're just making things much too stiff, and you know, at every turn we're being so afraid of what people might do that we're limiting flexibility, and limiting flexibility limits the ability to get work done. So I think it's a problem.
Okay. Paul?
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. I think I agree with Aubrey. In that a supermajority is probably too high a threshold, because the question I posed earlier, what happens if the request goes back and the council can't reach a supermajority threshold? Then what do you do? You know, I agree with James. I don't want requests for changes to be made willy-nilly. You know, you basically should have an issue that's pretty obvious to folks, and you know, once a charter is drafted, you get down to work and do it. And if you find that, you know, there are changes that need to be made and there's a good consensus for it, you know, my guess would be a majority would be enough of a threshold, but perhaps that's even too high. I think Aubrey's right. We need to maintain some element of flexibility, but not so much, and she's already clarified for us earlier, you know, that you don't create you know, these sorts of unintended consequences. I just think supermajority will be too high a threshold.
Okay, James?
Yeah, just to respond to Paul and Aubrey. I think if you can't get a supermajority support or consensus for changing a charter, then you go forward with the one you have. I'm concerned that future PDPs will see one side of a controversial issue, you know, taking this avenue, if we make it too easily, you know, too easy, taking this avenue to restructure the charter in a way that's favorable to their side of the, you know, on that issue. And it will become kind of a default mechanism to try and resolve those issues, as it will now suddenly have competing charter amendments in front of the council with non-exclusive voting thresholds, so that the council doesn't have to choose between one or the other or neither. The council essentially could, you know, approve both, you know, and then now we're back into the situation where we have contending charters. So I'm just trying to look down the road and how this is going to play out a little bit, and maybe I'm a little too cynical. Sorry about that, but you know, I think that contrary to something I think Aubrey said, which is that, you know, we're putting in some structure here and it's going to impede the amount of work that we get done. I think that too much flexibility can have the same effect. And, you know, you can essentially get into a position where groups are in kind of a deliberation paralysis and nothing ever really advances. So, you know, so I would stay with the idea that there should be a supermajority to make material changes to a charter. If I'm alone on that, then that's fine. I just wanted to get that idea out there.
I'm away from my machine.
Okay, Aubrey.
Would you include, for example, one of the most common changes that come out of working groups is, oops, we're going to miss our deadline and we need to change the date. Would you require, and that has to be approved by the council as well, would you require those sorts of things that we have that same supermajority?
Aubrey, you were cutting in and out. Were you saying like a change of dates? Is that what you were saying?
Yeah.
Okay. James?
I think really what I'm focusing on here, Jeff, is the charter questions themselves. You know, the dates or the timelines or, you know, those types of issues I think would fall under what you earlier, and I think you were just kind of brainstorming, but, you know, the idea that you had that there were administrative changes versus substantive changes. I think when you change the charter questions by adding, deleting, or modifying the language of a charter question, I think you fundamentally alter the topic of the working group and the policy, and then you probably invalidate a lot of the deliberations and public comments that had been received up to that point because you've essentially established a new context. So I think that, you know, dates, you know, moving work items around between related working groups, I think those are more administrative changes, but when you start talking about adding, deleting, or modifying the language of a charter, then that should be an extraordinary circumstance and should only proceed if it has supermajority support.
What do you think of that, Aubrey?
Yeah, I think that's probably okay.
All right, so Marika, then, can we... you're still on, right, Marika?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Can you summarize that one as well, basically by saying, look, there, with respect to modifications to the charter, we discussed on the call the option of having administrative changes and give examples of timelines or moving work between work groups require a majority of the council support. That would be majority of both houses. Whereas a substantive, and there's probably better words for it, but just in the, you know, substantive changes to, or substantive or material changes to the actual questions requiring a supermajority. And let's get some viewpoints on the list on those.
Okay.
All right, I know we wasn't expecting this much conversation, but I think it was very helpful, especially in light of, you know, the fact that we had the VI situation that was just, you know, last month or a month and a half ago, which was very instructive. So I thank everyone for this call. We will next week, next Thursday, jump on. I'm hoping number 4 and 5 are a little less controversial, and we can breeze through those. But, you know, we'll see on the next call. And in the meantime, we'll get those questions out and move forward. Thank you, everyone. We had good attendance on this. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you, Sarah.